now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, our 10-minute speaker, Chris from Bristol.
Hi, my name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, that's a lovely sound. I've been told that I've got 9 minutes, because time's been getting on a bit, so I think I'll be quicker than that, even, really. It's lovely to see such a big crowd come here to hear me. Thank you very much for coming. And before I actually get going, I just wonder if anybody does know Kinney from San Francisco, who's supposed to be standing here. If you do come across him, would somebody please give him a big hug from me? I was full of hope that that Dwayne, who was walking down here right at the last minute, was going to be Vinny, but he put his badge on and it said Dwayne, and I knew I was not going to be relieved of this. I'm actually very grateful to be here. It's a great honour, really, to stand in front of such a crowd of people. I feel enormously grateful to be sober and to have been given a chance to have a second life, really. My first go at life was an appalling disaster. I was a sad, miserable, lonely person until I found booze, and then I was reasonably content for about an hour or so. And I then had about 10 years of guilt, shame, and remorse, and disaster. And then I found Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a potted version of my life history, you'll be glad to hear. And I do just briefly want to talk about the first AA meeting I got to, because that's, I think, the most important thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life. I came to AA a very shy, very awkward, very frightened little person. Well, I was quite big. I was thinner than I was now, but I was quite tall. But very, very awkward. And I came to my first meeting. I walked up and down outside. I'd spoken to someone who'd asked me those 20 questions, and I knew I was an alcoholic. After each bender, I would know I was an alcoholic. Each time I'd gone out just for one drink and I'd ended up drunk and I'd ended up stealing a car or getting into a fight or something happened. And I just knew that I was an alcoholic. And this particular time when I woke up after the last bender, I knew I had to get some help and I got myself to AA. And I walked up and down outside the place where the meeting was and I was looking at the people as they were going in and I was trying to see if they were the sort of alcoholics that I thought that an alcoholic was a man who slept out and drank methylated spirits and had DTs a lot. And I wasn't really like that. I was 26 years old, and I drank in short, vicious benders with long patches of sobriety in between, months sometimes. And I couldn't really see that I was really an alcoholic. And I'd always had somewhere to stay. I hadn't always got there, but I'd always had somewhere to get back to. And I couldn't really see that I was an alcoholic. And something magical happened at that first AA meeting. I got welcomed by everybody, really. They were pleased to see me. And what happened at that first meeting, as I see it now, is that I got loved. I hadn't felt loved for an awful long time. People really hadn't wanted to know me. And at that first meeting, people put themselves out to come and say hello, to introduce themselves and to talk a bit about themselves. And I could see myself in what they were saying. They were talking about themselves. And although we'd perhaps drunk differently and we'd done different things and we'd drunk different sorts of alcohol, at least I could see that I was a bit like them. And I felt unique for as long as I could remember. I just hadn't realized that there were other people like me. And so it was a kind of a miracle, really. I left that meeting knowing that Alcoholics Anonymous was the place for me. I just knew it. I felt I'd come home. And I know some people struggle and hate it and all the rest of it, and I'm sorry to make it sort of a before and after story, but that's really sort of how it was. Something magical happened at that first AA meeting. And ever since then, I've known that AA is the place for me. And I feel more comfortable at some meetings than others. I don't feel particularly comfortable in front of all these people. But I still know that you're all like me. You've all been through it. You've been there. You've done similar sorts of things. You've felt guilt. You've felt fear. And you know what loneliness is all about. And it's just marvellous for me to be in a room full of people who understand those sort of things. Because I'd never spoken to anyone before I came to AA who had really any great depth of understanding about what I was going through. I'd spoken to psychiatrists, I'd spoken to probation officers, because I used to do some very strange things when I was drunk, and I used to end up in courts and hospitals and things, and none of them really understood. Not one of them did I feel knew where I was at all. And it was partly my fault, because I couldn't share about myself. I was cut off inside myself. And that's one of the gifts that I've been given in AA is an ability to share things about myself with other members of AA, and it's a great gift. Now, you may have or may not have seen me standing up when 20 was called out. So I've been sober 20 years, and just in case you think that this must mean that I'm incredibly spiritual and a more or less totally recovered alcoholic, I think it's worth telling you just a brief story about something that happened when I was 19 years sober, a long time ago. And in all the years that I drank, about 10 years, I had never, ever broken a shop window. Never once. And I can understand why people do it. It would be, there's quite an attraction to it, I think. And when I was 19 years sober, I had some problem with some car insurance. And I was having some troubles with money, which I still have. And I was having some troubles with my wife, which I still have. I hope this isn't being recorded. And things were just getting a little bit on top of me. And the car insurance was about the last straw, really, and I finally had to write yet another check out to this damned insurance broker. And I went down on Saturday morning to pay the check to the insurance broker, and he was shut. And I swung my leg back, and I gave the most enormous kick to this window, and it shattered in 1,000 pieces. And there was a momentary sense of satisfaction. But it was very, very rapidly followed by all sorts of feelings of, God, what am I doing? I'm 19 years sober. I've kicked this damn window and I've got to go and hand myself into the police. What on earth is going to happen? And so I don't... everything was all right. They didn't run me in. And I said, well, I'd only meant to give it a glancing blow. So they accepted. Nothing really bad happened, but it was a great lesson to me, because what I'd done, I'd let things build up inside me, and I hadn't been talking about things to people, and I'd perhaps got this idea that because I'd been sober all this length of time, I didn't really need to do this, do that, do the other, work the steps, pray and meditate and all this. And that was a good example of what happens to me. It taught me a very sharp lesson. Anyway, I think that's about 8 minutes. I will, before I go, I don't want to finish on a note like that. because I don't do things like that all the time. But it's just something that's a good lesson for me. I need to work these steps in my life on a daily basis. When I came to AA, I did not believe that there was any sort of a God, and I found some sort of a God. And I could not see that the steps were anything that were going to help me in any way at all. I'd come to AA to stop drinking. And I stopped drinking. I stopped at my first meeting and I didn't pick up a drink again. And there was a bit of me lurking away inside that felt that was it. And I was quite depressed, really, when I saw all the things I was expected to do. But I have to say that I've had a go at the 12 steps, and I have a go on a regular basis at the maintenance steps, steps 10, 11 and 12. I do find that some of my good intentions slip out of the window. I find that when things are sailing along fairly happily, I can ease up on looking at my motives, or on prayer, or on meditation. And I'm just so grateful that I'm a member of a group called the Fellowship Group in Bristol, that when I show signs of easing up on the program, they let me know just exactly what is happening. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm also very grateful to be here, and I'm very much looking forward to hear Clancy, and thank you very much indeed.
And before we have our speaker, are there any empty seats? If you have an empty seat, raise your hand. There's some people standing at the door. There's some seats for you. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Clancy.
My name is Clancy. I'm a Muslim. I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to be here tonight. Did you look at this format? I just said, thanks, speaker. And it says, thank you, Kenny. I I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be in San Francisco. I've been here a lot of times. I lived here, and and it's been a very nice evening for me. I want to, first of all, be sure to express a great deal of thank you to to the person they sent to meet me, who was supposed to stand and hold a sign saying Clancy. And unfortunately, she didn't find it possible to do that as I got off the plane. And so I went downstairs and I came back upstairs, and she was a little panicky because she got there a minute late because of the bad traffic. And I'll tell you something. Here's an airport full of people, and she looks at me across the airport and says, Clancy? I guess I was the only one who looked serene. I was the only one saying, son of a bitch. But she really been up for it. She found a shortcut home from the airport, and she's been an excellent host. I want to thank her, Janelle. It's not worth the applause. I got her name on the tape. That's enough. You know, I'm really old now and over the hill, but I sometimes get San Francisco reminds me, makes me feel young, whether I am or not. And I got in the car with her, and I could see that she was pretty, and I just... I got to talk with my shoulders. And she cooled me off quick. She said, how long have you been sober? I said, when did you get sober? I said, 1958. She says, oh, that's the year I was born. That's the bad thing about being old in AA. You get into 14 stepping. I don't know if that's when you're too old to 13 step, but sometimes they let you watch. But the old saying goes, that isn't true in my life. It's been so long since I've had sex, I forget who gets tied up. I don't know. I never talk like this anywhere else. It's just something about this sinful city that just brings it out. And I'm very glad to see a lot of my friends here. See half the entire AA group of San Jose lurking over there, poking each other. Don't applaud for yourself. It's so obvious. I'm a slipper from San Jose. See a lot of old friends. See the bishop back there, old Frank, with his 45 years. Frank doesn't look 45 years. That hat does. I'm glad to see my friend Dorothy here with many. If it weren't for those two, I would be the oldest timer in the room. And I'll tell you something. Once upon a time, I thought it would be wonderful to be the oldest timer in the room. But now I'm always glad to see people ahead of me there. I'll tell you. I'm glad to see him. In fact, when I was sitting next to Chris tonight, I told him, he said he was 20 years sober. And I'm sure he doesn't hear this much in Bristol, so I told it to him here. I told him it was very nice to see the newer folks keep coming back. I met Chris in Bristol. I had an opportunity to talk there a couple of years ago. And over there, they all talk the way he does. You know, it's just... Well, I don't judge. I'm certainly glad to be here tonight, though, for this meeting of glass breakers from many lands to discuss what we're all here about. As I said earlier, and I really mean this, this is not... anti-disestablishmentarianism. It's not easy being a smartass in this world, I'll tell you. A little different. We have a sign, we have a helped for the deaf in our group in Los Angeles. A little different. They don't actually sign, but they stand next to the podium, and the speaker said, "My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." And the our guy says, "My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." But anyway, I'm just in here filling in till the dance, so I'll know what I'm done when I notice the first couples coming by. I want to thank Ben very much for asking me to come up here. I really appreciate this, Ben, because as I said earlier, I really seriously mean it. I feel more poignant about this trip today for some reason. I've looked forward to it, and I get up here a lot, and I go to Marin County and San Francisco and Oakland, and I've been up the Bay Area many, many times. But today, for some reason, maybe there's a little drizzle in the air or something, it really harks me back to my first trip to San Francisco. And I grew up in a little town in Wisconsin, a little town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Somebody here from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Yeah.
I'm from Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
That's why I left. That's not really true. I met that young lady in the meetings in Eau Claire when I go back to the visit. And now she's out here, and I'm glad to see her. She's a dear girl. But I grew up in this little town, and early in the Second World War, incidentally, let me say one thing in passing. This has nothing to do with AA, except in AA we talk about emotions. And early in the Second World War, I had a great zest to go out and to kill Japs or whatever. And so when I was 15 years old, I ran away from home. Told my mother I was going to Superior, Wisconsin, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. Now, I was small and skinny, had a pimply face, and didn't know anything. I'll tell you why I did it. The reason I mention that is because there's a lot of young people in this room who, until this week, never had the feeling that was there in World War II, when most of the country was behind the country and everybody felt good about the victory. And I thought to myself as I was growing up, a whole generation, none of my kids ever knew what it felt like to be a young kid in World War II when everybody's going the same direction. And whatever your feelings about this invasion of Iraq, what it might be, you got the feeling when nearly everybody was going in the same direction, so different than Vietnam, so different than Korea, so different than Grenada, so different than Panama. Just a lot of people going in the same direction. And that's the way it was all the way through World War II. And it really was a great feeling. Everybody was up and at them. That's why I wanted to get out there and do something. And I was a dumb little kid. And this guy, I was outside of Minneapolis, hitchhiked into him, what the hell is going on? And some guy picked me up, and he was in the Navy, and he gave me a ride to Oakland. Now, that's a long ride. Now, I just accept that's what happens when you hitchhike. People give you rides. Where are you going, you know? And he bought all my meals, and he talked to me, and he drove. At night, we'd stop at trailer courts. They have me a little motel. We call them really hotels, but little cheap motels. And he'd give me a room, and I'd stay there, and I'd get up in the morning, and jump in the car, and away we'd go. Some nights we'd stay in the same room, and I'd have a separate bed and everything. And I just thought that's the way it was. You hitchhike a ride, guys will take care of you until you get where you're going. Years later, I look back and think, what a guy that guy must have been. I wish I had his name. And, you know, I wouldn't actually send him any money, but I'd mention his name on a tape. But what I remember most of all about it is this. I was telling him that I wanted to be in the Marines, go kill Japs like I'd seen in the movies, and make up for Colin Kelly and all the others who were killed. And he tried to explain to me nicely, and he said, "You know, you probably can't get in the Marines because you look kind of young." And I was, 15 and dumb. He said, "But you might possibly, if you really want to do something, you might go to the Merchant Marine. Get some Seaman's papers." And he told me about the Coast Guard office up on Market Street and how to get there. And he said, "I'm going to drop you off." He had to go to Alameda, I guess. And he dropped me off on the Oakland Mall about 5:30 in the morning. And I had never smelled the ocean before, and I couldn't believe it. And it's just, and hear the sounds of, ooh, ooh, and a slight fog and a little drizzle like there was tonight. And I got on the ferry. At that time, there was a ferry running from Oakland to San Francisco. I got on this ferry, kind of in the foggy ferry, and went across, and must have been a little later because the sun started to come up, and one of the golden memories of my life that is looking through that fog and seeing the hills and spires of San Francisco coming out of the fog, and Jesus, I couldn't believe it. And the smell of the ocean and noise. And I got off the ferry building, and he told me to go around and go out and walk up that little suitcase and walked up Market Street. That time there were two competing streetcar companies in San Francisco, and they all had tracks on the main on Market Street. So you saw four streetcars at once, right in the middle of town. And big buildings, and the smell of the ocean, and people, Bob, and I walked my little suitcase up Market Street. God, Dorothy had to feel that way when she got to Oz, I'll tell you. Just, and I found the Coast Guard office, and I went in there, and I guess they were really crying for merchant seamen, because I want to be a merchant seaman. He gave me an application. And the guy said, don't tell him you're 15, tell him you're 16 anyway. So I filled it out, put down 16. He said, you're only 16, boy. I have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, had my parents sign it. Brought it back. Now, it's hard to believe this in this day and age, but that day they issued me seaman's papers. And I said, what do I do now? So take me on the National Maritime Union on Montgomery Street, told me how to get down there, walked down Market Street, four streetcars come, buildings, smell of the ocean, sun out, couldn't believe it. Just found the National Maritime Union, they were just crying for people. They had me sign a waiver saying, I could take the union dues out of my first check. And they gave me a ship and sent me to the Embarcadero, told me how to get to the Embarcadero, my little suitcase, and I... Right across the Embarcadero YMCA was this pier. I found that, and I went down there, and there was the most enormous ship in the history of the world, as far as I could tell. Now I'm slick. I know it's just a little Liberty ship, but then it was... And I found a way to get on that baby with my little slip of paper. And I stood around and milled, and they were just... I guess they were good. They were going to go with or without me. I mean, they were just waiting for a guy. If he didn't come, they have to go. And I was out there just a few minutes, I remembered, and away they went. And I stood there, and they backed off. And I remember going underneath the Oakland Bay Bridge and saw Treasure Island. Somebody said there had been Treasure Island. I'd seen pictures of the World's Fair that had been there just a couple years before. And went by Alcatraz. Oh. I tried to see if I could see Al Capone or... Went underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, I'd seen a lot of pictures of that, you know. And it just kept going. And after a little while, I stood there and I began to realize something. This was taking a bad turn. The known Earth was going out of sight. And I guess I must have had an intuitive feeling that I'd made the first... in an endless series of career errors. I sidled up to some guy who looked like a boss and thanked him really very much for this opportunity, but I really had to get back now. We had a big English test Monday. I didn't want to miss that. And he wished me well. He told me to luck off. And somebody else said, get your fo'c'sle. That's your fo'c'sle. And I didn't know what a fo'c'sle was. But it sounds pretty ominous, I'll tell you, a fo'c'sle. I went to this room, the fo'c'sle just a sleeping area of the ship, and crew has fo'c'sle, a room. And what I found out later is that in each room there was a watch. I was with one of the three deck watches, and on each deck watch there were four men. And I didn't know that. All I knew is I walked into a room, and there were three of the worst type of people any small, skinny, pimply-faced kid could ever be with. And these kind of people are called men. And they just looked at me. And now I know why, because I guess as they saw me, they realized we are all going to each have to do three in the third man's work for one in the third man's work, because this punk ain't going to do nothing. But I could see there was some feeling of tension, so I... I told him some stories that used to go over big in study hall, and why don't you shut your goddamn mouth and get in your bunk? So I shut my goddamn mouth and got my bunk. They point out, and that ship was moving, and I was starting to get kind of sick, and I didn't know anybody. I really wanted my mother. That's what I... But I didn't want to say anything and ruin my image. And these guys got talking, and I was shocked out of my wits. Because I was raised to be a religious boy in a religious community, in a religious family. And these guys got talking about what they had been doing in the 3 days the ship had been in San Francisco. And I never heard of anything like that. I just couldn't believe my ears. And I thought, these, they must be, they've got black hair and they're sinners, they must be Catholics. But I just, I've never seen any close up, but I'd heard about them a lot. Norwegian Lutherans run a pretty tight ship about that. And they were talking about SEX, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't want to give the wrong impression. At the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were good. I mean, they were... If I'd known those pictures came to Earth in San Francisco, I'd have stayed over a day or two, you know. But I never felt so bad, I don't suppose, in my life. I've never felt any worse. I felt as bad, but never any worse. Thank you very much, Chris. And I, one of the guys went to his locker, into his sea bag, took out a bottle of whiskey. Now, just to show you how different things are now, at the age of 15, to the best of my knowledge, I had never been in the same room with a bottle of whiskey. Just was not done where I lived. But he had a bottle of whiskey, and I knew what it was, seen it in movies. And he turned to one of his friends and says, "You want a little snort?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "You want a little snort?" I said, "Yeah." He turned to me, and he had a very unpleasant look on his face. Today I'm very slick and sophisticated. I might call it a demeaning look or a supercilious look or any one of a number of types of looks. But then I just broke it down into pleasant and unpleasant. And this was unpleasant. "How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And he shoved that bottle in my face. And I just thought at it, but I just couldn't talk it. There's a phenomenon most often connected with athletics. It's called choking. And what that means is that when there's a lot of pressure, an invisible hand comes out of your throat, out of your shirt, and grabs your throat. And you can wait with two strikes, and here comes a pitch, and... You see it a lot with the Giants. That was just a for instance. Or you wait till the big, till the playoff game and you choke like the fort. No. Well, they do it in a lot of sports anyway. But it happens in the real world too, you know. And I'll tell you, you'll notice that sometimes your mind can go 100 miles an hour, but you just... And I could just feel myself getting upset, my little pimple standing right up. And I wanted to just shout at him. I couldn't talk, but I'm going to shout at him. "I guess you don't know I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. Norwegian Lutherans don't drink whiskey. Even if they did, I wouldn't drink whiskey, because I promised both my mother and grandmother I would never drink whiskey. And even if I hadn't promised them I wouldn't drink whiskey, I would never drink whiskey, because..." This is very sad. Who's laughing down there? I was an abused child. And the inside of this child is an adult waiting to get out. I hope it happens soon, too. But, you know, I had most of my knowledge of the world by going to movies. And I went to a lot of movies in the late 30s and early 40s. And in my day, heroes never drank. Bad guys drank. Errol Flynn never took a drink in his life, as far as I know. Bad, well, never in Sherwood Forest he didn't. Bad guys like Basil Rathbone and Claude Rains and real crap heads like that all tried to steal the secrets, send them to King Philip of Spain. Buck Jones never had a drink in his life, as far as I know. All of some rustler named Slade, you know. That's break Buck Jones's legs. His horse, anyway. And there's no way I'm ever going to drink. And I was just trying to think how to tell this guy to take that stinking bottle out of my face. Can you imagine sitting like that and having a guy run into it? You think you're mad enough for a little snort? And I was just thinking of an answer to tell him, and I heard a voice say, "God damn right." And turned out I was a little weak under pressure, too. And that day I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first bottle I was ever close enough to drink of. And I took a drink of whiskey that burned my mouth, that burned my throat, that burned my stomach, that burned my throat, that burned my mouth, and burned his shirt the last I saw him. Get the bottle away, you little son of a bitch. And I really feel bad. You know what I think? I have most of this, of course, I've had to recreate. I'm not sure of every detail, but what I can remember is this sneering, scornful laughter. I don't suppose there's anything in the world that insecure people makes them feel worse than public humiliation, being sneered at publicly, and you can't do anything about it. I can understand how people under such could take a gun and kill somebody. But I had no tools. I couldn't do anything to anybody. A bunch of guys. I was a little skinny kid, and I just hated it. I thought later, there was one thing I might have done to get that guy, but I'm glad I didn't think of it, because I might have been thrown over the side. But what I might have done is, "Hey, buddy, lean over." "Yeah." "Take that." Yeah. Zip right in the old eye. Well, you got to play the cards you're dealt, folks. But all the way across the ocean, they treated me like a stupid little punk. And my mind's rationale was, they treated me like a stupid little punk because I threw up that whiskey. It never struck me. They treated me like a little stupid little punk because I was a stupid little punk. That's why. But you got to have a rationale. And every day when nobody's around, I'd sneak in and take a drink of that slop and try to hold it down, because I wanted to look like a man to those guys more than anything in the world. I remember we got to Pearl Harbor, and the war had been going on terribly long. They're still working on Ford Island, getting some of those battleships out of there. Dreadful. And I guess the smoke was down, but you could feel like you could smell the smoke. And the guys were looking, and I was down taking a drink out of that guy's bottle one more time. I'd been doing it for a week and a half by that time. And I remember that day I took a drink of whiskey that burned my mouth and burned my throat and burned my stomach and stayed there. Now, if I could just do this and smile. Oh. And as it stayed in my body, I had a funny... Would somebody throw some water on those two there against the post? Think of it this way, kid. When I'm alone, everybody's alone. I don't know why I'm never invited back anymore. I try to be nice, try to make friends. But that whiskey stayed in my body. I had a strange feeling. I guess I would call it a surge now. But all I would think of to say at the time, "Poor hunchback girl. You're supposed to ring the bells at 9 o'clock. And that's her. There's more business up here than... Usually I get a little further in my talk. Anyway, I felt a surge of something. What I really felt, I suppose, is what I would think of then, and I would think of, I could say, defend it now. It made me feel significantly better. That's all I thought about. It made me feel significantly better. And I didn't become a terrible old drunk at that moment. Later on, I got drunk in Pearl Harbor or Honolulu, and we just see what it's like, and I tried to drink, and just made me feel significantly better. Later in the war, I went in the Navy, so they got old enough. And I drank. And drinking was always kind of a fun thing. And It's like harnessing atomic energy in a sense. Just nothing makes you feel better, but sometimes it gets out of control, but so what? And I think about, you know, I didn't pay much substitute. In your teens and 20s, whoever you are, in your teens and 20s, that's when you learn about life. You learn about relationships, you learn about drinking, you learn about smoking, you learn about sex, you learn about working, you learn about becoming self-dependent on yourself for income, you learn about everything. And you try to stick with what you like and avoid what you don't like, but you wind up pretty much establishing yourself, your patterns. And what I discovered that day, alcohol made me feel significantly better. Now, I would say it a different way now. Alcohol enabled me for the first time in my life to feel the way men looked. And nothing else ever did it. Today I know that men don't feel as well as they look, so I was feeling better than they were. So who would know that? I went in the Navy, and in the Navy, I was over here at Pleasant in California, at the end of the war, being sewed up, and they came around with tests through gray ladies, and I've always been good on tests because I would do a lot of reading, and I hit that test, and so they gave me, I'm still a junior in Eau Claire Senior High School, but I got a high school equivalency, and I went to college after the war, started in the spring of 1946 at Cal. I was asked to leave because I was such a goof. No big deal. I went back to Wisconsin, went to college in the fall, and went to college, was in the first real class of post-war veterans. We stood around on street corners trying to look like steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers. Hustling poor old profs who'd say, "Son, you didn't get your term paper in." He'd say, "I was working on it, prof, but I got taken by what it was like over there." I said, "You take as much time as you wanted, Mr. Imlesland." And I'd say, "Thanks, prof." And I'd say, "You dumb bastard." But I went to college, and I got married in college. I broke my family's heart in a sense. I married a Catholic girl. Well, you know, because people with black hair always seemed exotic to me. There was none in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. And I married this girl, and she was a wonderful girl. My grandma told me, she said, "Sonny, don't marry a Catholic." I said, "Grandma, we went over there in the Pacific fighting the forces of fascism and bigotry. So in the brave new post-war world, there's no more religious or racial intolerance. And I know you mean well, but I'm going to marry this girl. We love one another." And I married her. And my grandmother was right. It's not that she was a bad girl. She was a good girl. But she was a good Catholic girl. And there's something little Norwegian boys never learn about until they find out too late. If you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family, ready or not. And I used to plead with her and say, "You know, can't we use birth control?" "No." "Can we just get something for sanitary purposes? They sell them in a vending machine over in Rocky's Rockaway." "No." So I really gave her all I got. I said, "We don't have to take orders from some old fool in Rome in a white dress." That didn't do it. She had a priest come by one day, and he gave me an hour and a half on the rhythm system. Maybe you're familiar with that. That's the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened intently, and I just couldn't pick up that beat. I started a second career as a national distributor of small Catholics. Perhaps you've noticed I don't have much hair in front. That's from, you know how many times I've said, "You're what?" But I got it. There's something going on outside the door, and I want it. But I went out in the world, and I became a sports writer, a newspaper sports writer. Then with those consonants is clearly that. But I stood outside of a Skid Row mission dying, an old man, it seemed like to me, my life was over. If a guy would have come up to me and said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I'd have said, "I'm not, but I wish I were. I wish I were. I've been going to AA for years, but AA doesn't have any answer for cases like mine." And if someone would say to me, "Why do you drink?" It would just depend on my mood. If I were in one of my psychoanalytical moods, harking back to my thousands of dollars I spent in psychoanalysis. I might explain to them why I drink, because I was psychologically scarred as a child. I found out in psychoanalysis I'd been religiously repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church and left with a deep sense of inhibitions. I never knew it at the time, but I found out later, and it really made me upset. Because they really only have two laws in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. You don't sin, and you don't screw around with Catholics. And I was a little weak, I sinned, and I screwed around with Catholics as well. So I was going to hell, but it wasn't the church's fault. In fact, if I knew then what I know now, I would have formed Adult Children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple codependents and been pissed off every week. I discovered that I'd been raised in depression. I'd been deprived as a child. I never knew that. But when I found out, can you imagine how sad that makes you feel? And it all started innocuously. The doctor saying one day, "You mean the same instrument at this time in 1935? You didn't even have a bicycle?" I said, "No." I got thinking about it on the way home. I began to remember I never had anything. For about 2 months after that, every time I wanted to throw myself into a real meaningful depression. Now, people like us, we don't want depressions. We all need a depression every so often just to rinse off. You know, it's like having your own portable cross. You just set it up and hang for a couple hours. Don't forgive them, Father. They know what they do. But every time I wanted to get a little of this, all I ever had to do was visualize my mind's eye a little tousled-haired, apple-cheeked, blue-eyed, kind of brave little fella, standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles. Don't worry about me. I'll go into psychoanalysis later. I can't go on right now. Took me almost 2 months to remember. In 1935, nobody in Eau Claire, Wisconsin had a bicycle. One kid finally got one, and we beat him up and broke his bicycle. But I discovered a lot of things. I just love psychoanalysis. I had breakthroughs and understanding. Because most of my life, I'm sure, I've been faced with intense emotions. Intense seems to me intense sensitivity, intense anxiety-ridden sometimes, intense lonelinesses, intense resentments, intense feelings of emptiness, intense fear. And I've always wanted to know why, except always if I can find out why I have these feelings. Other people don't seem to have them as far as I can tell by looking at them, so they must be indigenous to me for some reason. And I've always looked for why. That's why I don't mind spending money in psychoanalysis and anything. Just let me, because I've always known, if I can find out why I've got these feelings, I'll be all right. And I spent thousands of dollars and years of my life in various therapies, psychoanalysis and metaphysics. I don't like, you know, I was getting near the end of my career, I was getting a little goofy. I got deeply into metaphysics. I guess there are people today still going to metaphysics, but it's not the same anymore. There's so many little people have been in it. But in my day, just sensitive, intelligent people were there. And I was about half crazy by this time, so I really had a head start. And I, at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And I thought that would make them admire me, but they put me in the insane asylum. But I've always spent a lot of, I've spent anything. I read books. I read, did a lot of things. If I could just find out why. Now, I'm sure a lot of people in this room tonight are in the midst of that search. You would be really unnatural if you weren't. Because people like us are always on, most of us are in that search all the time. People not like us are in that search. You look at non-alcoholics. They stagger from transactional analysis to transcendental meditation to S to primal stream therapy. All one after another. I'm not putting them down at all. Everybody lies out there wondering why they're different. But certainly we do. And let me tell you something. As one who has given much of his life and many, many thousands of dollars to this search, Let me give you some good news and some bad news. The good news is you can find out why you have these emotions. In different therapies, there may be different explanations, but they will all be satisfying and intellectually defensible. The bad news is it doesn't help. You wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. As I've said many times, the best analogy of my life I've ever been able to think of is as though I run the deck of the Titanic and it hits an iceberg and goes down. And everybody rows away as fast as they can. But people like me say, I'm not getting off this baby until I find out why this happened. And you may find out why, and it makes you feel intellectually superior. You people out in the boats! I know why! It takes a little experience to discover knowing why you're going down is of no value whatsoever. But I searched for this, but the best help I had all these years was alcohol, and I never thought of it as a problem. Sometimes I was drunk, or sometimes I had a hangover, but alcohol never seemed to be a problem. Alcohol is the best friend I have ever had. Now, that sounds terrible to say that in an AA meeting, I suppose, but to this day, it still hurts me when I sit and hear some old fool get up and say, that damn alcohol was poison. All is what poison. Just terrible. It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of mine, you know. Just a minute, Slim. She may be a pig now, but she didn't used to be. So, alcohol filled my holes. Alcohol enables me to go from being the easily rejected to being the rejecter. What a difference that is. Most of my life I've been... A tone of voice can ruin a day. Somebody's glance can ruin a day. When my holes are filled, some of you young guys must have experienced this, some of the old guys have it, Frank did. Sit in a bar late at night, watch the miracle of alcohol take place. Watch some old beast become beautiful by closing time. I might sidle over to such an old queen and imply there will be delight beyond her comprehension. Would you like to join me in the old Chevy? Now, she would say, no! When my holes are filled, I feel sorry for her. No. Too bad, bitch, don't come begging tomorrow. If that would happen to me sober, I would hang myself. Drinking is a great thing. The only problem I ever had in all those years, I have an unfortunate tendency to overfill my holes. But drinking does more. If you are like me, a few drinks will make you feel better than a year of psychoanalysis. A few drinks will make you feel better than an understanding of the oneness of the spirit reaching forth to infinity. A few drinks will make you feel better than this reading the complete works of Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche. And the trouble is I drank sometimes too much because I was too intense. But when I drank, I was a much better person than when I wasn't. That's why I was in an alcohol. My problems come to me when I'm sober. When I drink, that's what is good. I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. Frank was 3 years sober. Looked very young then. Had the same cap. But now Chris said we went to his first AA meeting, he was loved. I wasn't loved at all. Because today 22 doesn't seem like very young in AA, but then no one had ever heard of anybody within 15 years of that. And it's just like going on that deck of that damn ship again. A bunch of old guys said, who are you? And I thought, who are these old burned out old fools in their late 30s and 40s and just look like God's waiting room? You know, that I was thinking about that earlier tonight. I looked around the room. There's so many young people in AA today. You young people, I mean, in our group, we have a lot of young people. There's a lot of young people here. I've watched young people a lot in the last few years in AA. And I don't know if you young people, anybody's ever told you this. I hope they have. But you young people in AA today are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And a lot of old-timers like me are glad we're going to be dead. Come on, let's get down to business here. But I went to AA off and on for the next few years. I'll tell you what AA is. If you're for people here at 5 days sober, you know as much about it as most of these people. It's a place where you go to stop drinking, right? Then after a while, you return to God, right? And you show your gratitude by helping others, and you live happily ever after, right? What do you mean wrong? That's what AA is, and everybody knows it. And I went to AA off and on, a lot of states, a lot of cities. Never, after a while, I realized it couldn't help people like me because the thing that was different between me and alcoholics is their number one problem was alcohol. And they all said, if your problem is alcohol, you're in the right place. I always knew, not me, pal. My problems are some kind of screwed up thinking and feelings, and no matter how I feel, it's going to be different next week, and I want things to be right. I remember God telling me once one time, I think your problem is alcohol, and I never could say anything. I've always been inhibited and choked. But I mean, I can't now, but I couldn't then. But I want to just shout at him, you think my problem is alcohol? Why don't you find a way to get into my house tonight about 2 o'clock in the morning and find your way into my bedroom and stand there? Maybe you can watch me lay in the dark with my eyes wide open and looking out in the dark and my head going 100 miles an hour and my gut churning and my mind thinking, what's wrong? Why are my kids not the way they are? Why is my family the way it is? Why is my job screwing me around? Why don't people like me? What the hell is wrong? If you watch that for an hour, you won't think my problem is drinking. You will understand why I drink. That's why I drink. I drink because it fills holes that nothing else fills. And no therapy fills and nothing else fills. And I got to somehow keep from drinking too much as the heat's up. And many years later, I found myself being thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And all my victories behind me, and all my achievements, an old man dying on the streets, 31 years old, all over, dead, family gone, children gone, parents had ripped me off. Cannot think of a single person in the world who would accept a collect phone call. And that's a lonely feeling on a cold, wintry morning. And so I walked 71 blocks up to the corner of Wilshire Fairfax, where there's an A club that I'd been asked to leave a week or two before for being half drunk and insolent and snotty. And I hung around that club, and I finally wound up sleeping in the back seat of an abandoned car in the parking lot in some tall grass. And I just hated it. I just hated it. People, I've been around AA a lot. I read the book, I did a lot of things over the years. And little pukes that I wouldn't hire to be my gardener 3 years before that, up being supercilious and demeaning to me, for Christ's sake. Well, you go to the meetings, you turn it over to God, it's going to be all right. You put the plug in the jug, it's going to be fine. I just wanted to just to leave me alone. I wouldn't, you know, if I hadn't had the bad breaks, I wouldn't even be talking to idiots like you, unless you're the servants' quarters, for Christ's sake. Get away from me. And they did the same thing then as they do now. They say things like, get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. I found a guy who I'd seen in the movies. He'd been a character actor, played loving roles, and asked to be my sponsor. And turned out those loving roles he played were just an act. He should have won the Academy Award for every one of them because he was a nasty, demeaning, intimidating, supercilious guy. He never shared of anything with me once. He just told me and I was so intimidated I couldn't even get away from it. I had no place to go. My abandoned car was right there at the club. And he intimidated me into taking actions that I already knew about for years. And it never struck me. I had never taken them. I had known about them and discussed them. And little by little, he intimidated me into taking actions. And I hated him and resented him. But somehow deep inside of me, I looked back and I must have respected him because I had to realize he knew me for what I was, a bad person. The people who liked me, I always liked, but I had no respect for them because they were too easily fooled. I know that in retrospect. But there were several times in my first year, I'll guarantee you, if I would have had the money, I used to fantasize about getting the money somewhere and calling the World Service Office in New York and turn him in. Just, I just want you to know, there's an old timer in Los Angeles killing newcomers. And I'll tell you his name and address. Now, I never get to do it. Now, it's many years later, things will look a lot different. When I talk to the World Service Office of New York, I say, no, I'm not. I've been on both sides of this fence. I'll tell you, I've lain awake at night and thought about vicious, nasty, thoughtless sponsor. And I've slept while others have lain awake and thought about me. And on balance, I prefer to be the one sleeping. But he made me take action. And little by little, my life began to change, very slowly. And I stayed, almost ran away several times, got fired as a dishwasher because of my attitude, got fired as a janitor because of my attitude, got fired as a furniture mover. On the first day of my job, I was in a sensitive mood that day, and the guy said, you without the tape, you bumped my lamp. I said, no, you're mistaken, sir. I broke your goddamn lamp. You can't tell. You can't push creative people. I finally held a job when I was a year sober, wrapping packages in an advertising agency. Same kind of job I had when I was 14. I was 2 years sober. I finally got a job as a writer in a medical corporation. I said to my sponsor, I've been squirreling away money. I said, I put aside some money. Going to get some front teeth. He says, I thought I told you to send money to your kids in Dallas. I said, I've been sending money, Bob. A little something I got on the side. He said, that stinks. Send your kids that money. I said, what? Jesus, they got front teeth. He said, send them the money. So I sent them the money. And I had to learn to carry my lip like this. A lot of people didn't know I didn't have front teeth. I thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I went to work every day, and I went to meetings almost every night. And by the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that corporation. When I was 6 years sober, they brought me into Revell along with another guy, big hobby kit manufacturer, and we created their number one sweepstakes. I was able to swindle a surplus jet off the Air Force in Arizona. I presented to some kid over in Oakland. He won the sweepstakes. I don't know if the little shit ever did with it. We just took pictures and got out of there. And he didn't. That's the way it is, the wonderful world of advertising, folks. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I went into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all walked around popping our fingers and saying things like, what's coming on down, baby? I personally put Sonny and Cher out of my office as a no-talent, know-nothing person, people. And they had a little surge after that, but they're not together now, you notice. Met the Beatles, met the Rolling Stones, thought they were all just goofs. I hated them. I thought they were stupid. I didn't like rock and roll. 10 years sober, downtown doing public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober as a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the wrinkle of green in my wallet. Fled to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Somebody gave me a timekeeping device then, and that was the end of that, I'm telling you. Oh, this is a very nice story, but I want to quickly, I know we're going to get eager, we're all eager to get to the dance. You young folks. One of the things about, I was thinking earlier about, you know, having these Catholic children, there's one of the major differences between my era and you young people. When I was a kid, people walk in and say, hey, give me a pack of cigarettes and some condoms. And now at least the director near my house, they can say, hey, give me some condoms and some cigarettes. I don't care. I guess that's progress. But what I primarily learned in all these years and all the meetings and all the help I got was this. I learned that everything I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was false. And if I'd have kept believing it, I'd have died. Now, doesn't that sound incongruous if you're new? I had to discover I'm not here to get off alcohol. I'm not here to return to God. I'm not here to help others. to show my gratitude. If I believed these things, the chances of me dying from alcoholism run to about 98%. He said, how can that be? I want to just for a few minutes talk to you about maybe changing your perception. You might save your life. First of all, you get here to get sober? Of course you're here to get sober. Everybody knows that. Once you get off alcohol, things get better. False. False. You are not here to get sober. I'm going to tell you something that sounds strange, but it's the most important single fact I ever learned, and I learned it in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just the only therapy I've had since I've been sober. I'm going to say this slowly because it's going to sound strange, but it's the most important. If you heard nothing else I heard said tonight, hear this. If your problem is alcohol, you are not an alcoholic. And conversely, if you are an alcoholic, your problem is not and cannot be alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound weird and upside down, like some kind of a treatment center breakthrough? But I'm convinced that's a message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm convinced that that's what all we do here was all about, the book. I'm sure I'm one of the very few, maybe Frank, but I don't think so. I think I'm the only one in this room who sat and talked to Bill Wilson for it in about an hour when I was 5 years sober, and that's what he thought, as of 1963 at any rate. But you say, of course the problem is alcohol. It's got to be. False. I could disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is a problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment facilities turn out recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn out recovered people. They don't. Jails turn out recovered people. They don't. They turn out sober people with varying amounts of information as to what's wrong with them. But I'll guarantee you, if they be an alcoholic of my type, sooner, unless something dramatic happens, sooner or later they must eventually always begin to drink again. That sounds terribly depressing. Well, if it isn't alcohol, what the hell is it? Is it something metaphysical they're not telling us? Is it something spooky only the old-timers know? No? It's something you hear every meeting you go to, but if you are like me, unless you get a different perception of it, you will die from it and never know what the hell it was. It is not alcohol. It's something that sounds like alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. You say, well, alcoholism, alcohol, same thing. Semantics. Not the same thing. Not the same thing. I guarantee you, if you be like me, the day will come when your life will depend on remembering the difference. What is the difference? Well, I could give you an hour-long talk on that. A few years ago, I gave an hour-long talk on that. I got a phone call from Orlando, Florida, to go down and talk to the American College of Psychiatry annual meeting in Orlando for an hour on the differences between alcohol problems and the disease of alcoholism. And they're going to fly me down there first class. And I thought, I really felt sheepish because I can tell them over the phone. You know, that's. But then I thought, if I do that, I'll never get to Disney World. As I said earlier, I've not had a happy childhood, but I've had a long one. Just. So I gave them an hour-long talk, but I can give it to you in one sentence. The difference is this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this strange, denigrating, destructive, emotionally eroding, mind-destroying, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking as such has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so emotionally painful you can't stand it. Not funny. Not funny. That's what causes alcoholics to die. The fatal part of alcoholism has always been sobriety eventually becomes unbearable. We've all got our own reasons, but they're all germane. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That just makes you what science calls intense neurotic or acute neurotic. You live in reality, but you live with a lot of obsessions and pains and problems and conflicts. They are the people for whom the psychiatric cultures of the world have been designed. They are all over the world, psychiatric cultures are people with those emotions looking up to the doctor saying, doctor, why am I different? As for whom the medications have been slated, the lithiums and the valiums and the Prozacs. It's kind of in some areas of AA today, there's a little surge of people taking Prozac. And they say, well, this is, it's all right. I refer you to the Wall Street Journal of February 7th, just in passing. There's a big article in there. In America today, there are 12 murder trials being tried at this very moment in which the defense is the killer was on Prozac. There are any number of suicides, and yet some people take it all right. It almost seems as though people like us, it gets to, well, non-alcoholics, it doesn't get to. So I would be very careful about ever taking anything that changes your perception of reality, because if you do, people like you and me pay a terrible price for it. But anyway, but they're not alcoholics because of one other thing. And if you remember this, this will all become understandable to you. What is it? Alcohol must have an unnatural effect on you. In every generation, 5 or 6% of people who drink get an unnatural effect. Nobody knows why, and nobody can ever figure out why. But they do. But, and you all hear that. It's called, here, the allergy of the body. Or the doctor, who said that later, called it extreme sensitivity. But what is that special effect? What's that unnatural effect? Because we all hear about it. What is it? Well, maybe you stay drunk all the time. You hear old-timers say, I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. Let me tell you an interesting fact. That's false. It is physically impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory. One of the rottenest parts about being a drinker, you keep sobering up again and again and again. Well, maybe if you're an alcoholic, you can't handle alcohol. That must be it. False. Alcoholics handle alcohol better than social drinkers in any test or any situation. If you've ever been to a party where alcoholics and non-alcoholics drank the same, I'll guarantee you the alcoholics drive the non-alcoholics home. But it's hard to conduct that test because you can't get the non-alcoholics to drink that much. They say, oh, no more for me. I'm starting to feel it. And the answer to that is, feel this, you wussy. Oh, yeah. We just come through another wonderful Christmas season where California led the country. Now it's all over the country where they have these traffic stops to catch drunken drivers at Christmas time. They're not trying to catch people like you and me. If they were, they'd have them up all year long. They're trying to catch people, non-alcoholics, who get drunky poo at Christmas and don't know how to... And they don't know how to drive drunk, and they run into trees and each other. And they get stuck in these traffic stops while people like you and me, who know how to drive and drink, get stuck behind them and have to sit there endlessly, you know. Hurry up there, for Christ's sake! Yeah. Well, maybe it's that alcoholics act bizarre. You hear all these speakers, all these famous speakers, they all got bizarre stories. And when I was new, we just loved to hear those bizarres because we measured their spirituality by how bad they were, you know. Why, did we have a spiritual speaker last night? He escaped the penitentiary and raped 7 nuns. Paul. False. Bizarreness has nothing to do. You may have a bizarre story as an alcoholic, but that's not what alcoholism is. I'm in a different situation than most of you today. When I go to work in the morning, I have to step over the bodies and arms and legs of men and women dying from alcoholism to get to my office. And when I go home at night, I step over the bodies and arms and legs of dying men and women. Some have died since I came into my office. And some of these people have never been bizarre once, and they're dead. They get more and more catatonic, just the opposite. Well, what is it then? What is this unnatural effect? And there, if you understand this, you're home. It turns out the unnatural effect is it isn't what it does to you at all. Just the opposite. It must do something absolutely unnatural for you that it doesn't do for most people. It must almost instantly alter your perception of reality. It must almost instantly change your relationship, your environment. It must almost instantly make you taller and more self-contained, and then smaller and less frightening. And if it does that, you will find something that you'll never find, to my opinion, in any other drug. I've been working with addicts for over a quarter of a century. I know a little bit about heroin and how they get down, the euphoria they get to. But you know what kills heroin addicts? They always overdose, because pretty soon they can't get there anymore. They can't get there. It's always on the edge. Heroin kills a lot of people, but only because they're trying to get the euphoria they're used to. Cocaine addicts, smack addicts, or crack addicts, or whatever it is, free base, get way up there. Omnipotence, wonderful. But relatively soon, the terrible addiction kicks in, and your body starts to go, and when you try to stop, comes all the side effects of speed, paranoia, and terrible restlessness, and terrible edginess. And the alcoholics, when alcohol is working for you, you're not up there and you're not down there. You're right where you are, only with all your holes filled. Just you want to try me, copper? Take your job and shove it, Mr. Carlson. You with anyone, Granny? Nothing changes, but it looks the same. And the only problem is, if it does this for you, it erodes some of your abilities to deal with reality. Because eventually drinking does something to you, and then you got to stop drinking. Then you realize the problems of being sober are more intense than the problems of drinking. So you drink until you have to stay sober, until you have to drink. Scientists who study alcoholics say that alcoholics get to a point sometimes where they literally must drink to preserve their sanity. When you drink, you have to stay sober. Stay sober, you have to drink. That phenomenon is called alcoholism. And today in America, it is estimated over 90% of alcoholics still die drunk with all the help available. And you know why? Because they die convinced of one thing. I'm not really an alcoholic. Leave me alone. My problem is not alcohol, goddammit. My problems are real. And I drink to escape. And what they don't realize, they've just defined the disease of alcoholism. You think, well, that's why it is on Skid Row. But over the years, I've had an opportunity to sponsor a lot of unique people. The guy that put the flag on the moon. People who were making $250,000 at the bottom. Movie stars, priests, doctors, truck drivers, guys perpetually out of work. What do we all have in common? We were all in Skid Row? Not at all. We all lived in a world where sobriety became untenable and drinking became untenable. And that is alcoholism, and that kills people like you and me. So get over the idea that you are here to get sober. Being sober will make you feel worse. There's a certain novelty being AA and sitting in meetings, but pretty soon your pals will come back one by one. Restlessness, self-pity, resentment, anxiety, depression, tension. One day you realize, I'm not like these people anyway. My case truly is different. They don't understand. So I want to tell you this. Don't count on staying sober or being sober. Eventually, when the pain starts to hit you, remember that sobriety is the vestibule of Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to step out of there eventually and get into AA. And then you find yourself getting into commitment, taking actions whether you agree with them or not, doing the things, hopefully getting a sponsor who can sift out what is applicable and what isn't, so you don't have to make the decision with your own distorted perceptions. And eventually take the steps to bring about something that nothing has ever done in the history of the treatment of alcoholism in 5,000 years, to bring about an incremental spiritual experience, which is known as a spiritual awakening. So, don't think you're here to get sober. It'll just make you feel terrible. True story. Secondly, going to return to God? False. I remember telling my sponsor when I was due, I'll get out of this quickly, but I telling him, I said, I'm sorry, but I cannot return to God, because if God exists, I'm going to go to hell and screw that. I was trying to be an intellectual atheist once I realized I was going to hell. Another guy and I in Dallas were so cute one time, we set up a dial of prayer for atheists, where you could dial this number and nobody ever answered. But I said, I cannot return to God. And he used to wave his finger in my nose. Says, for God's sake, him! That's what I really used to miss my front teeth. I just, but I wasn't going to give him the pleasure of gumming it, I'll tell you that. He says, can't you get this through your head? You don't have to return to God. Oh, I said, return to a power greater than myself. I'll bet that fools those infantile people in there, but not me. He says, you don't return to that either. You never return to anything. There's nothing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that ever asks you to return to anything. Just the opposite. Returning is going back to distorted perceptions and unnatural obsessive living. Because you got to get out of that. There's only one sentence in the book that talks about returning to anything. It says, some people in the old days would wanted to return to normal living. But he said, but a little puke like you never had any normal living, so you don't have to worry about that. And I said, oh yeah. But he said, you got to come to believe in something. Can't you believe in God? And I said, no, I can't. He said, do you believe in AA? And I said, no, I don't. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? He says, I guess you are. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. Now, a lot of people joke about that, but I'll tell you this, you're new or having difficulty. I would much rather see you believe in your sponsor that you believe in than to pretend to believe in the God you don't believe in. Because eventually it gets to be 2 o'clock in the morning, and you can fool them, but you can't fool yourself. And if you have got nothing to turn to, you're dead. And so I hated him, but I respected him in an offbeat way, and I did things I didn't already do. As a result of taking those actions, I eventually came to believe in AA. And I eventually, over a long period of time, I don't know how I did it, little by little, with the help of a lot of people, came to believe in God as a loving force rather than a vengeful, hateful force. It took a long time, and I had to work out an awful hard. But I'll tell you, it paid for itself a few years ago. Just this one instance paid for more than paid for everything. Sitting in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, with my mother's little casket. She had died. I was so glad she had died. She'd been so sick, and we'd been very close for years. And looking at that church, sitting in a room like this, and thinking, how many times have I sat here, and then after I left here, thought about this hundreds and thousands of times, thinking of a God in this room who hated me for his being a sinner and would destroy me. And now, thank God, I've come to understand the same God is in this room that's in my meeting in West Los Angeles. A God who means well for me if I can get my own butt out of the way, little by little. And I thought to myself, I never would have ever learned that if I hadn't been a dying alcoholic. And I looked at that church and thought, this church is full of people who never will find that out. They're living here in fear and doubt and self-abnegation. I am so glad that I was finally forced to change my perception. Don't think you're here to return to God. You may have the same God, you may wind up in the same church. But do it and it looks different. Then you're going to show your gratitude by helping others? False. Just the opposite. You help others and you get gratitude. You take the actions here, you take the actions despite how you feel about them. There's not a word in this book that mentions motives or why you should do it. It says, take these actions. Action is the magic word. Not love, not understanding, not spirituality, not insight, not anything. Action. When all else fails, work with another alcoholic. Why do that? I'm so screwed up. It's a therapy for self-obsessed goofs. When I think about that goof, I'm not thinking about this goof. And it's just like a weekend in the country. See? Let me help you. But you take the actions and you keep taking them. I don't mean you have to become a fanatic or obsessed, but you keep taking them because little by little they redress your perception of reality. Because I believe what AA does is do exactly what alcohol does, only very slowly. Changes your perception of reality, changes your relationship to your environment, makes you more self-contained and then less frightening. Just wonder. So you're not here to get sober. You're not here to return to God. You're not here to show your gratitude by helping others. If you can remember that, it gets much easier. The last thing I want to say before I sit down is sometimes people give you trite phrases and they just almost make you crazy. When I was in Texas in the nut house, I wasn't in there for drinking. I was in there as a suicide because I'd stayed sober too long trying to help my family. And I got in the nut house and I escaped. They brought me back and gave me a lot of electric shock treatments. And when I came out of that, I was a little slower. And I realized I was in there on a psychiatric commitment. I was never going to get out. But I noticed they put me in an alcoholic ward. I've been in and out of AA for about 6 or 7 years, so I knew how to pretend to be an alcoholic. So I pretended to be an alcoholic, eventually got transferred to the alcoholic ward. And the first day I was there, they had outside people come in and put on a meeting. And I'd never been to a meeting in Texas. And I'll tell you, if you've never been to one, it's something else. They are, and it's not only Texas, but Louisiana and Georgia and Mississippi and Tennessee and North and South Carolina, all of those poo scoopers down there, all got. Here we say, my name is Jim and I'm an alcoholic. It was, hi Jim. Down there they say,
My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this wonderful program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing drugs since March the 22nd, 1980.